Hello and welcome to another Talking Rugby Union podcast. And once again, we have teamed up with Looseheads to bring you a special episode this week with none other than Crosscode legend Jonathan Davis. Now, we have to split the episode up into two parts. Part one discusses his work with Looseheads and his career in rugby union and league, whilst part two focuses on Jonathan's return to union, his work within the media, as well as his all-time 15 to take to Mars. So coming up next, we will be focusing on part one of the special podcast with Jonathan Davis. Enjoy listening. Hello and welcome back to another Loosehead podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union. I'm your host, Chris Hill, and as ever, joining me are the Looseheads trio of Rob, Dave and Mark. How are we doing today, lads? Are we all right?
Very well, thanks, Chris.
Good, thank you. Cheers, Chris.
And firstly, many thanks to everyone who's listened to the Looseheads podcast over the last couple of months or so since we've been in lockdown. We've had some great feedback. I know Rob's been telling me about some of the feedback we've had. So the guys do brilliant work at Looseheads, so to be able to bring in some big names to chat about the foundation as well as their rugby careers has been brilliant. So make sure you do listen to all the podcasts we've been releasing. They're all over Looseheads' social media on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. So get in touch and get listening to those ones. So a big thanks to Rob, Mark and Dave for that one. I think a big thanks to them as well for getting a very special podcast lined up today. I mean, last week we had Sam James and Deli Solomona, who we did talk about their careers and obviously a union and league connection with both of them. But today we'll be covering both codes in a bit more detail because I'm absolutely delighted to say we're joined by a rugby legend of both league and union. It's Mr. Jonathan Davis, OBE. Jonathan, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure. Afternoon, lads.
And like I said there, it's brilliant to have you on today, Jonathan. I think there's probably only one place to start with yourself, and it's obviously your continuous superb work that you've been doing for the Velindra NHS Trust. I mean, it looks very grueling what you've been doing on Twitter and social media, Jonathan. I mean, 26 miles for 10 days and a 2.6 challenge. I mean, just tell us a bit about why was it important for you to set up that challenge initially?
I think it's not only for Velindra. You know, my chosen charity is Velindra because of the cancer, you know, background. But my dad passed away and my wife passed away, so Velindra looked after my wife while she was being treated. I was approached by a friend of mine who's kind of working for large participation kind of charity events, or London Marathon, I suppose. So what they try to do is raise the awareness because of everyone's on lockdown. Fundraising is stopped dead, really, because it's, you know, group participation. Most of the runs and cycles and a lot of individual stuff, but they need backup as well. So they approached me and said, look, you know, we need to raise the awareness of the 2.6 challenge. So what it did is creating an opportunity for people then to do anything that they want around the 2.6 or 26 or 260, whatever they wanted to do. And then not only one specific charity, but people are, you know, they choose a charity because they've something happened and they've been helped out. So I did the 2.6. I thought 2.6 miles isn't enough, really. I thought 26, nice ring in marathon. 10 days is my number I played for Wales, and also it was 35 years to the day I made my debut that it came out. So that's where I did it. And from there on, everyone's gone on and done this challenge for their, you know, respective charities. So it's just helped all the charities across the UK to, you know, to keep the funds coming in at this difficult time for everyone. So it was okay. I listen to a lot of podcasts and a lot of put a bit of music on, so I get a variety of stuff. But yeah, it was just to do something with a charity, and it raised, you know, a couple of, you know, £1,000. It was great.
Yeah, and those beers and wines afterwards, Jonathan, when you finished that final ride, must have tasted even more sweeter.
Yeah, it's you try. You know, if the weather's nice, it's very dangerous. You sit in the back garden. What's the first bottle of rosé pops, you know? If it pops at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you're in for a long shift. So I try to get out of the way in the morning so I could enjoy the day as well. So yeah, but it's been a great initiative, and I hope that a lot of the charities have just realistically been kept afloat like many businesses.
Yeah, and I've been right in saying as well, Jonathan, I think the target that was on the Virgin money giving page was 5,000 to begin with. So to be over 23,000 is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we got, I think the last thing was about 28,000, which is great. it's just going to kickstart any other ones. And my friend, a lot of my mates now are doing this mad thing. They're doing 1,000 miles in May. So that's like 2 hours a day, every day in May. And maybe if the golf course is open next week, they're going to be struggling with that because they all want to play golf. So it's, but they will raise over 100,000 odd. I got Gareth Bale involved doing a bicycle kick with 26 keep you up ears. You know, for him to do it is brilliant. And Sam Warburton and Geraint Thomas came in and did all this stuff. So yeah, it's been a great initiative, and the response on social media for everyone to do things has been ridiculous. Of course, we all, you know, pale in insignificance after Captain Tom Hardy's efforts. But you know, if he can do it at 99, you know, that is inspirational that everyone else can do it. And you know, it's been a brilliant response, typically British, I think.
Yeah, definitely, Jonathan. And as you say, it's been inspirational watching all the charity work you've been doing. And I guess part of that 2.6 challenge as well is about keeping active during this difficult time. And Rob, just to bring you in, I guess that's the message which Lucid's also embraced, that keeping active and staying positive by doing challenges like this that Jonathan's been involved with does help cope with people who may be struggling during this time.
Yeah, it's great to see, you know, Jonathan and so many other people get involved with challenges, you know, here, there and everywhere. It's been a difficult time for everyone at the moment. You know, it's a time where we shouldn't forget about our mental fitness. And one of the things that we say is to keep active, stay active, you know. So if you get out there and have some fresh air whilst exercising, then it's brilliant.
I think people underappreciate how important it is. I think that I've been lucky and I've done it throughout my career, and I think I remember at the end of my career, I was on a treadmill, and I after I run about 2.6 miles, right? And I thought, what the bloody hell am I doing? Mm-hmm. And I stopped, right? And I stopped for 6 months. I did nothing for 6 months, right? And it wasn't the physical aspect of it that kind of got me back into it. It was the mental side of it, because I've been lucky now. I think I've cut the, I love my Guinness, and I've cut that out. So I'm down to 2 pounds over my fighting weight when I was playing. I've lost about 6 or 7 kilos. But it's mentally that's important. It's physically you feel better. But again, if you know, with the mental state of mind, I feel, if I don't train, I feel a bit dirty. And it's not, if people say, oh, you've done it all your life, but it doesn't matter what it is. I had a bad back for a year and a half. My two discs had kind of degenerated. So I was in agony, like, you know, walking on for a year and a half. And all of it, I was doing operation on February. But for some reason, touch wood, that my two discs are fused now. And I've been just walking along the cliff pass of the Goa Peninsula. And it's so important just to get out there and do something, because it does keep your mind sharp, you know, and you feel a little bit better. I'm lucky I've done it now for 12 years. And, you know, we've raised over, at the moment, I think we're over £31 million. So, you know, for a great hospital. And we've got great supporters and ambassadors. But I've just kept on doing. I've done a couple of bike rides for them. And they were going to go to Vegas next September. Warburton was doing it, Sam and Shane Williams. Whether that's going to go ahead, we don't know. But now there's another one in Mallorca next April. And I'm thinking, right, I was going to retire from cycling, but I thought I feel fresh now, so I might do another one. So it's just brilliant, because it's a life experience when you do that, and it just keeps you active, keeps you a little bit on the bike. But you're right, it's communication, routine, you know, trying to keep a little bit positive. But you know, talking, I talk to my mum every day, even if she's you know, sick of hearing me. But you know, I know straight away how she is by picking the phone and the tone. And she's 80, she's 81 this year. So you know, if you think she's a bit down, I'll drive down then and just sit outside the window. I give her cockles and lava bread a couple of weeks ago to get her iron up and everything, so she was happy. But it's so important just to, you know, keep in touch with someone and just make sure they stay positive, because it is really tough, you know, getting up in the morning and thinking, oh, geez, what am I going to do today, like sometimes. So that's, you know, it's very important to keep in touch and talk.
Absolutely, Jonathan. And Dave, just to bring you in on that, to have Jonathan involved in sort of the Loosehead social media posts on Instagram and Twitter must be really positive for you guys, because as we've said throughout when we've done these podcasts, the importance of mental health across, you know, players past and present is key when delivering the message.
Oh, completely. And to have somebody with sort of Jonathan's experience and stature in the game kind of getting involved just adds extra weight to it. But I think kind of it's been so important doing these sorts of things. It just helps create sort of a real community feel. And I know social media can get a bit of a bad rep at times, but it's been a nice opportunity to show that, you know, there's a real positive side to it as well. I think kind of we're creating quite a nice community out there that people really feel a part of.
I think it's crucial for me, and I've come across this a lot, you know, and a lot of people make it about the transitional period in, you know, when you retire. But I think it's important when you're going through it, because you have down times and up times, you know, but also you're living it out, sportsmen live it out in the public eye. So some players can't, you know, cope with criticism. I never worried about that. You know, once the game was over, I couldn't do anything about it. So just get on with the next one. So I'm sure it didn't happen again. But like, you know, I've got a lot of friends with mental problems going back a bit with the winger, Fatlenelli, Carwin in the 88. And then a couple of years later, he took his own life. So I've known, you know, these issues now for about 30 years. And it is tough. And I think it's maybe even tougher now because of social media, but also because they are getting paid to play, and there's more pressure on them. So, and I think that talking, if I could talk to players, if they wanted to chat about how you do it, because I think it's prep. It is a lot of it is prep. If you can prep for the next step in your career, I think you don't worry about it. So you can enjoy your career. And I think if rugby clubs or regions help in that way, you know, I think it'll be a lot easier, because I think there's a lot too much emphasis on strengthening condition and analysis, where that could be used to look at players and look beyond rugby. So I think that's it's a massive step, and doesn't matter how prepared you are, that leap from playing to retirement is very difficult, because of you never ever replace the adrenaline rush you get as a player. So you've got to, what takes over then is your adrenaline of going into a new career. And then when I speak in an after dinner speaking, I get that gut feeling. I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing this for? But, you know, once you finish, it's, you know, it's a little bit okay. So you've got to replace it in a way, but it's important to prepare. I think preparation is key.
Do you think enough's done these days from kind of clubs to help players prepare and make that transition, or is there still kind of a ways to go?
I think, you know, I'm not involved enough to answer that, you know, convincingly. Yeah. I do think that, for my own opinion, I think there's, you don't need to train as much. I think there's overtraining. And having had the experience in both codes over 30 years and still, you know, talking to people, people say, oh, you're out the touch. You're not out the touch. You talk to people every day. And if anything, you talk more to people now than you did when you were playing. So, yeah. You know. So a lot of idiots on social media have got no idea. They just bang on about things, or, you know, past it, washed up and all that, you think. But, you know, you do your research and their prep. So I think there is space in the player's diary and schedule so that they can do more in prep for post-career. And I think having something else to think about makes you enjoy the sport even more and not worry about it. You know, I know certain players, like, off they box kick badly, they can't sleep at night, you know, because the box kick wasn't high enough or too far. Well, that's a load of bollocks. Unfortunately, you know, you just got to go, right, why worry about it? Why worry what you can't control? You know, that's gone now. It's like hitting a golf shot, and you're thinking, oh, why worry about that? You can't hit it, you know, hit it again. So wait till you get to the ball, and then have a, you know, it's just, I think the prep, there's enough prep. They got to prep these players so that they take their minds off the sport. So when you go back to training, they enjoy it. Not, I knew once I turned up in training for Widnes and I turned the engine off in the car and I turned my brain off the same time to go and train there. And I thought, that's not good, that isn't. You know, my heart's not in it. So you've just got to keep focused and having a balance in life, even when you're playing. You have to have that balance. Because even when I went to Widnes and Warrington, I was still a poor player, but I was an amateur because I worked. I worked 3 days a week as a salesman. And I kept in touch with reality and realised how important and how enjoyable rugby was. But I put everything in perspective.
Because I was gonna say, Jonathan, a bit later on in the podcast, but as we're talking about it now, in terms of your transition from playing into sort of the media, was that something that you'd always wanted to pursue at the time, or were you already thinking about what you were gonna do after you finished playing?
No, again, you know. Best laid plans went all up in the air because my wife was diagnosed with stomach cancer. So then everything else is on hold. But what I did throughout my career, a lot of the press officers in sport shield their players. Oh, they don't want to do it. You know, they don't want to do it. The more exposure you get, the more comfortable you get. So all of a sudden, when I never shunned reporters, always spoke to them after the game, you know, like the Warrington Guard, you know, the Widnes Weekly. There's a guy stood outside there waiting for a quote. You know, he's doing his job. So I speak to them, and luckily enough, all the three people, the two people that I spoke to in the Warrington Guard in the Weekly and the Widnes Weekly, they all went on to be editors and producers to the BBC. So I knew them all the way through. So the exposure I got from doing interviews, seeing the boom microphone, seeing the cameras, you get used to it and you know you're comfortable with it. So I was asked to do television then, and I had no prep, no training. You just gotta crack on. If you're good at it, you are, you're good at it. And you slowly modify. At the start, it's very difficult, but then you've got to explain and what's, because my role is commentator says what's happening. My role as a co-commentator is what is happening. And it takes a while to adjust to that because you still got the player's frame of mind. But once I went into it, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it gave me the flexibility then with my kids, obviously, in the week. So, but what it did then, I couldn't do, you know, coaching or nothing like that because the television would have been a conflict of interest.
And we've seen you obviously working in television, Jonathan, but is there a career for you in singing? I know the guys at Loosehead's produced the video of A Wonderful World and you finished off superbly. So is that something you're going to pursue or?
No.
That's not straight now.
You mentioned Niall Horan from One Direction. Replied.
Yeah, that's the way. That's what you do. You get him involved and then you get a million hits from all his fans. I was thinking about it. I'm like, yes, oh, God, my Twitter feed went berserk. All his fans would retweet in his comments, but no, I was you know, again, you do these things. I sang on Wednesday night, I had too much rosé on Wednesday, so me and my wife were singing. Oh my God, what a mess. Hell yeah. Thursday was a clear, wasn't a good day Thursday.
Well, obviously, Jonathan, we've loved talking to you about Looseheads and sort of your involvement with the foundation. But if you don't mind now going on to what is a very special rugby career of yours, and we'll start right at the very start. And for you growing up in Wales, Jonathan, I mean, for me, having covered the sport for a few years now, it just seems that rugby is such a massive part of society, and instantly it feels so much weight behind the sport when you go to Wales. What was it like for you growing up in the country?
I think the important thing is, you know, you have a rugby club in a lot of the villages, and it was kind of, you play at all different age groups, but I think the most important thing, it's the centre of the community. So you'd have, I remember, you know, training would be Tuesday and Thursday, game on Saturday, so the club would be full then. The women would come in and cook the food for the players, but also then Thursday night you might have a disco night in Chimsaron Rugby Club, you know. So it was a centre of the community and everyone knew each other. And anything that happened in the news or any support that people wanted, it would kind of resonate, you know, through the rugby club. So I think it was vitally important for, you know, for the whole village. And yeah, I just enjoyed playing for them, played with my mates all the way through till I played for the school, I played for the youth, you know, played, and then I just went on and played for the first for a season or so. But it was just lovely. I thoroughly enjoyed it, going to different parts of Wales and, you know, either winning or losing or getting your head kicked in. It was part of growing up, I suppose. So it was you know, it was a very enjoyable part of my life.
And you mentioned the community feel, Jonathan, as well. And if I'm right in saying your father was part of the local club as well, so was it a natural step for you to go there before moving on to Meath?
Well, it wasn't a natural step because, you know, I'd never achieved anything in my school days. I didn't have any international honours or anything. But, you know, I just enjoyed playing. I enjoyed keeping fit. My dad my dad married my mum. My dad's from Cloonhenry, which is in Tennessee. So as you do, my mum dragged into Trimsara, and then he played for Trimsara, and he captained Trimsara, and then he started the youth team off. So, you know, I knew everyone because I was a pain in the ass on the bus, like, you know, as a 13-year-old, like, travelling with him. And I just collected the balls, you know, got lace tie-ups for the boys and everything. I just enjoyed being around the environment. And, I was going to play. I played for Trimsaran first. I'm proud of it. And I wouldn't have, if I hadn't gone to Neath, I'd have stayed to play for Trimsaran. I had plenty of offers to go to other local clubs, but I'd have just played my days out there. But Neath spotted me. I think Phil Bennett gave him a ring. And I went to Neath, and, you know, it just kicked off from there. But it was a very important part of my life. And, you know, I just regard myself as a Trimsaran boy because they were very supportive to my family was there. And I think that when we needed it, my mum still lives there, you know, and I still give them sponsorship or try and, you know, help them in any way I can. In fact, there was an open night on the 16th of May. They've just opened a new rugby club, and I was going to do a Q&A. I haven't been back here, you know, for a long, long time to do anything. So there's going to be a Q&A. They're going to ram the club out, £15 a ticket, like sausage and chips. And then everyone's going to, you know, do a free Q&A for them that night. And I was going to stay in my mum's house then. So like back to the old days, find my way home and then crash out.
And Jonathan, we've been planning on getting you on the podcast for quite a few weeks, and Mark has spoken so highly of you. I haven't known you from his witness days, and he's talked about you being rugby royalty. I hope Mark doesn't mind me saying. He's picked out as well, Jonathan, a try that you scored for Neath against Bath. I mean, that must have been I watched it this morning, actually. It was quite a special try.
It's weird because if you look at it, it was a clash, you know, Battle of Britain, they said. Well, Bath were maybe the best side in the UK. And it came down, you know, Wednesday night under floodlights. And you could see, you know, the steam rising from the pack of forwards. And Stuart Barnes was playing. So it was just an opportunity to, you know, to make a mark and make a name for myself against English champions. And it was a brilliant game, actually. And, you know, and sometimes people say, oh, what were you thinking when you did this and did that and everything? I just felt I was in the zone that night. I made a few breaks, kicked a couple of drop goals, and you had Andy Robertson there. It was current English back row, and you had Barnsley and Gus Scott and all, Chris Martin. So it was a chance to, you know, make a mark and maybe significant. Because I remember going home then and... it was on Sports Night, the try. They showed the end of Sports Night. They showed on the end of Sports Night. Enjoyed the try. And that was then basically, you know, people kind of noticed me, I suppose.
And Mark, why was it for you to highlight that try? I mean, I watched it this morning. The show and go and the darts and the line was something that definitely stood out for me.
Well, I think what Jonathan says then, I felt like I was in the zone. He looked like he was in the zone as well. And that sort of introduced him to the stage he was going to grace for the next 10, 12 years. I can remember watching the very same programme on Sports Night.
Yeah, it's a long time ago now.
Yes.
Yeah. And you talk about that try in a way, Jonathan, that sort of made you known. But I mean, Wales recognition comes along from you, you're playing for Neath. And I know that the Triple Crown in 1988, if I'm right in saying, was a very special moment for the country. I mean, I think it was the first for a decade. So how is that something that really stands out for you during your time representing your country?
Yeah, I think, I really appreciated playing for Neath. You know, they gave me the opportunity to go to the next platform, and being a Llanelli boy, you know, they didn't want me. So playing for Neath was really, really special, really inspiring, and it was amazing because they would, which is nice, because the second you would tell me, people would ring up, you know, to see if I was playing, and you know, they'd say, right, yeah, he's playing, and then the crowds would come, you know, in their thousands and fill them all out. And then, because then he'd say, like, you know, sometimes he's not playing, so there would be a big hit on the supporters. Okay. So what they would say, like, I was playing every game, and then everyone was in the ground, and then remember they'd say, like, there's been one late change, Jonathan Davis. Is, like, they were in the ground then. In the ground, so the secondary was happy, everyone was happy. So to hear that, and that I gave, you know, people a lot of pleasure watching me play was very important, because that's where I wanted to play. I wanted to run, I wanted to, you know, create excitement. And playing in that pack where they, you know, they were a great rucking team, the ball was on, you know, having quick ball. Then I played for Wales, and then, you know, it's amazing. I tell all the kids, it's all you got to do is, if you work on your core skills, your core skills will adapt, because the only thing that changes when you go up levels is the pace of the game. And if you can cope, if your core skills are good enough, then you will slowly adapt to the pace of the game, and you make it. So it's I thoroughly enjoyed playing, and playing for Wales 88 was good. It was odd then, because everyone kind of beat each other in the Five Nations. France were France had their glory days in the 80s. They were brilliant side, and I enjoyed playing against them. But yeah, we went 88 to the Triple Crown. We had two lovely games to start. We beat England and Scotland, and it was nice weather, and we wanted to play attractive football. And oddly enough, it's usually the worst weather in the start of the Six Nations. It gets nicer. But on this occasion, it was the other way around. So we had a horrible weather in Dublin. We just managed to win that game. And there was a dreadful day in Cardiff when France came. We lost by a point. If that, and that's the one regret I got, I have. You know, it would have been great to win a Grand Slam for Wales. And we were so close to it. And if we'd have had a nice weather, I think we'd have won that day. But it was, yeah, you know, memories, that's what you look back and think, you know, especially, you know, with everything on lockdown, you know, everything comes up on social media. And people remember the games that have been shown in Wales, the 88 game, and against England, against Scotland. And it's just enjoyable to watch it, because we try to play with a smile on our faces.
Yeah, and during that time as well, Jonathan, I know the year previously Wales had got to the semi-finals of the World Cup, if I'm right in saying, and sort of the expectation around, you know, you've done that, you've won the Triple Crown, must have been really, really big. So when you did have maybe results didn't go the country's way, was that really tough to take?
Well, I think losing, no one likes losing. Again, when you step up to international level, you know, it's magnified 10 times, so a million, 100 times, you know. So it's not nice to lose. And, you know, rugby's so important in Wales, it kind of affects the mood of the workplace on the Monday morning. So you felt a lot of pressure. But, hey, it was amateur Monday. So it was, if we'd have stayed together that side, I think we might have achieved things and gone well in 91 World Cup, but going to New Zealand and you have new coaches and they were just different level to anyone else in the world at the time. So it was, I just enjoyed playing. I enjoyed playing for Neath, I enjoyed playing for Llanelli, and I just enjoyed playing for Wales. And I think that's, I look back on it now and I just wanted to play every game, you know, I just because I enjoyed it.
You talk about that squad sort of not staying together, and you were, you know, one of the players to leave Union behind at that point and move over to Rugby League. And I know Mark's looking forward to this section of the podcast with a strong witness connection. But did you feel at that time, Jonathan, where you were making that decision, that whether you were going to continue in Union or League was very much at the top of the agenda?
Again, you know, because I suppose it's a lot to do with my background and upbringing. I'd love to have gone to, you know, A-levels and then university, but once my father died, I lost a little bit of discipline. But I left school then because my mum, you know, needed some extra income. When I had the opportunity for Neath, I tore my cruciate ligaments and was told if I didn't have the operation, I'd never play rugby again. So when I went, I always wanted, you know, to be the best, and I wanted to win. So when I went to New Zealand and realised that they were on a different level, because they were kind of like semi-pros, they were getting looked after. You know, they even then they say, look, you just worry about your running. You know, they'd be compensated like for training with sponsorships, or the employees are happy, and they were good. So I knew nobody in the Northern Hemisphere was going to win anything for a long time, and but it didn't happen until 2003 when England won the World Cup. So I just thought, right, all that thinking, I turned a few clubs down before rugby league clubs down, but I just thought the timing was right when Dougie came and spoke to me. And it was just basically the family was my priority. Scott, my son, was 6 months old. So I thought, right, okay, it's time to put myself first and get security for my family.
Me and Mark have talked about sort of your move as well to witness, Jonathan, and he said that when you were thinking about which club you came to, Dougie came to your house in a big car that had witness rugby all over it. Was that right?
And he didn't exactly go under the radar. And the funny thing is, we had a chat, and I sat down with Jim and Dougie in a lawyer's firm in Swansea. And the funny thing is, we sat down and thrashed it out, and they wanted me to sign for 7 years. I thought, that seems a long time. You know, if I don't like it, if I'm shit in it, like, I got to stick for 7 years. I thought, oh no. So I said, look, we'll do this deal and that, and we'll thrash it all out. And I shook both their hands and said, if you get that deal for me, I will sign. And they were like a bit dubious about it because they wanted me to sign there and then. I said, look, I promise, I'll give you my word, I'll sign. So that night, while they were waiting for the committee to deliberate, you know, and thrash it out, Jim and Dougie went to a pub in Llanelli, who I was playing for. And they walked in, and the barman said, oh, you're Jim Mills and Dougie. Yeah, 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 you know. What are you doing down here then? Who are you after now, you buggers and all that? And the pub they'd walked in, there was Norman Gale, who was the chairman of Llanelli RFC, the club I was playing for. So they said they were signing Tony Clements. and then the following, they rung me at 12 o'clock and they said, the deal's done. And I said, look, gave my word. I went down the following day and signed in Swansea in the lawyer's office then. So, and then that was it. Off I went. And I hadn't really, I thought it through financially and everything, and I looked at the witness, but Wigan was a big club, witness going well, and I thought, right, if I'm going to go on, I'm going to sign for a good club, and I'll try. The first challenge would have been to make that side, and if I made that side, I knew that I would make it then, because looking at the witness side, was they were a great side, you know, with great footballers. And they were up there, maybe them and Wigan, the best two sides, maybe St Helens now and again. But it was a conscious decision to go to a good side and then pit my wits against the best players in that club then.
And Mark, you were, of course, heavily involved with Widnes at the time that Jonathan joined. I mean, what kind of impact did that signing have on the club at the time?
Well, there was a big boxing game, match rather, Frank Tyson. Mike Tyson was fighting Frank Bruno, and that was, I think, February 1989. And honestly, a bit like Ray French would say, you know, this young lad from Widnes, for me, Jonathan Davis signing for Widnes was the biggest sports story I'd ever seen. I was 22. I'd grown up in the town. I'd gone to university in Manchester, and I used to, every Sunday, because it's a game played on a Sunday, I'd be down at Norton Park. Widnes were a good side, don't get me wrong. Jiffy's just said it. They were, you know, Dougie Lawton, if Dougie Lawton says it's Tuesday, it's Tuesday. They were putting together a proper team. Jonathan Davis signing, my word, it was like none of us could actually believe it. We'd seen him some years before getting a rubbish pass from Robert Jones and chipping the ball down the right and outpacing Ian Paxton and scoring a try. And you think, how has he done that? The try he scored against Bath for Neath. How's he done that? How's he dodged between that? Because he was about 11 and a half stone. How is he going to cope in rugby league? It was the biggest story I'd ever seen. And if I'm not wrong in thinking, I think Jonathan's first game, when he was sort of protected for a while, they chucked him on the wing. And within 2 minutes, he'd almost had his head taken off in that World Club Challenge game.
Yeah, it was odd. Like, you know, we might remember, you know, Paul's Chippy on Lower House Lane. We used to go there, you know, after Saturday. And I was talking to Connor Cody, you know, the Wolves captain. And he lives in, where he lives now. And he used Crompton Fish and Chip Shop. You know, he knew that. So we are, because I knew straight away, if I'm signing, I'm going to live right in the mix, because I've got to absorb everything. I want to get to know the people. I want them to know me, because if I was living in North Wales or Chester and things weren't going well, then I'd be the one they'd all be having to pop at. So I thought, right, I'm going to really, you know, embrace myself and get in the middle of it. And I lived in Sankey for a bit. And then I lived in Widnes, Higher Ashton, by the tavern pub. And I enjoyed that, you know, and I enjoyed the whole mixing, because that's what I was used to when I was playing for the clubs in Wales. And playing for Wales, where, you know, you go out and have a couple of pints after and mingle. So I didn't expect the reaction I had when I saw one in Wales, you know, because they were, I think, about shocked that I'd gone, I suppose. And then all, you know, then when I went to Widnes, the paparazzi, it was unbelievable. You know, I don't think, I'm not blowing smoke here, but I don't think I've ever seen it since in rugby league, because there's a photograph of me when I'm walking on against Salford. There must be about 100 photographers. And it makes it worse work, because I went the wrong way to start. I went left instead of right coming up the tunnel, so I was on my own for a bit. Until Colin Myler called me back. But it's just an amazing kind of photograph and the pressure. And you know, I don't think it was odd. I just put it to once. I sorted everything out, like, you know, where I was going to live and look after the family, you know, and doctors and all that, which is important. And then I just focused on the game, and I trained hard, you know, listened to everything and everybody. And then waited my turn then to have the opportunity. And, you know, that's a broken on the wing, kicking goals. And then the more I got used to it, then, you know, I could play, you know, in most positions. So it was a brilliant time. You know, if you look at the people I played with there, Kurt Sorensen for one, right? You know, he'd lead the charge. Then you had Tony Myler, who was a magician.
Great player. Yeah.
You know, and if you'd have been... hadn't been as injured so much, because he got injured because of his, how brave he was and how hard he was. You know, he stood up in a tackle and offload and then somebody smashed him. So, but he was an amazing player. And then you had the two Hume boys, were like two little Rottweilers, you know, but then they would support you through a thick and thin. Then you had like Derek Pike. Lee, right? He was the slowest guy ever, but what a footballer he was. So I'd know what I... Mossy Cloto, I played against the Mossy Cloto in Wellington for Wales. So I knew all, I kind of looked at these boys in training, and I knew who I'd follow, knew who I wouldn't follow, knew who'd pop a pass to me and where they would be. And then you'd have Joe Grimmer then playing, Phil McKenzie. So they were all good footballers and we all bought into it. And yeah, you know, I think we were unlucky. We lost a couple of semi-finals, which was huge. Huge disaster there for the club financially and for us, because we wanted to go to Wembley. But I really, really enjoyed my days in Widnes. Really, really enjoyed them. And, you know, the rugby we played was absolutely fantastic.
In that world of you've played for a lot of high performing teams, and you've seen and commentated on a lot of high performing teams. I'm enormously biased, But that witness team of the very late 80s, early 90s, it seemed to just had it all going on. It was a bit the United Nations of rugby stars, Kurt Sorensen the captain. It was, you know, just how was it like? What was it actually like? What had Dougie done?
I think when he spots a talent, you know, he's watching Wellington versus Wales, okay, on television. He spots a Mosi Koloto, you know, Tongan player. He flies over to get him. Then you see, you know, he's got Phil McKenzie as a footballer. Then, you know, you had Paul Hume as a different kind of hooker. And, you know, so we had Tony and Andy Currier, then a Darren Wright, you know, two Northern lads. It was just assembling everyone. And I think what he had was, one was he looked at talent, and two, he looked at character. Because everywhere you go, you've got to have the right characters. And then he plays Martin. Of course, Martin is there as well, for you, and Alan Tate. So you had, you know, the Borders, London, and then you had a Welshman. Then you had Devereux and Moriarty. So he just noticed good players and he brought them in. And I think, you know, Wigan were an outstanding side in the 80s and 90s. But, you know, they were outstanding because they had more money than anyone else. So if someone played well against them, like Andy Platt, they'd buy him. Mm-hmm. Andy Gregory, they'd buy him. Ellery Hanley, they'd buy him. You know, so, and with a mixture of great Wigan kids, you know, your Fazzes, your Clarks, your Sean Edwards. Mm. And then, say, some a centre got injured, like, I don't know, say, Dean Bell got injured. All of a sudden, I'm playing against Dean Bell. Someone, he gets injured. Or they got Gene Miles playing now. Oh, you know, you can't beat that. So, you know, the other clubs who compete against Wigan in those days made an amazing, amazing job, you know, to make it kind of competitive. But it was just a pleasure to play. You know, I really enjoyed, because everyone was different, from different backgrounds, but we all gelled, because what we did as well, because it was a smattering of union boys, every Sunday night, the boys, the league boys would go home. So we said, no, that's not good. You know, we got bonding sessions here. So every Sunday, you know, we would end up
at the Hillcrest.
Well, Hillcrest would be the last stop with Harold. But, like, you know, we'd have a road trip all the way up, you know, and then we'd end up singing karaoke in the Widnes Leagues Club, you know what I mean? And then we ended up at the tavern, but everyone got to know us. Yeah. And then Stevie O'Neill had a pub as well.
Yeah.
We had Mike O'Neill. So we had a brilliant time, and, you know, it was just nice, you know, it was just a great atmosphere. Everyone got along, you know, and it was just, I love the people of Widnes, I love the people of Warrington. And I just enjoyed my time because I loved the game. I worked hard, I trained hard. I was very fortunate, I didn't have many injuries when I was up there. But, you know, it was just a brilliant time in my career.
Well, one question I have to ask is in that, when you signed, from right and remembering, it was very early, January 1989.
January the 5th, I think.
Yeah, undoubtedly, you would be going on that Lions tour, the one to Australia. But you'd signed, you'd made that decision, and you'd gone north. And what you said earlier about the Noel being, you know, is Jonathan Davis playing? And yeah, he's playing, and the crowd would go up. I know that was a fact at Norton Park. It was a rugby league loving town. We'd all go there. But if Jonathan Davis was playing, absolute box office. You any regrets at all over moving north?
I get asked this a lot. And I think I've never been scared of making big decisions. You know, because I've had to make them all my life on my own. When my dad died when I was 14, so all the major decisions I've had to make, you know, because you don't want to worry your mum. She's always been there for you. But so when I looked at it and thought, right, and it is a regret, I suppose, looking back on it, because 89, yeah, you know, I suppose I was going to be the number one standoff. And I would have enjoyed it behind that pack. you know, and maybe if I'd have gone on that, I wouldn't have gone rugby league, because if I'd have been successful there, you know, you never know what happens. But I made the call. Dougie convinced me. financially was good for me and my family, because again, I worked, and I was up, I worked 3 days a week when I was up in Widnes and Warrington. I didn't want to be full time, so I was it was maybe a regret going in that early. I could have waited maybe till the following season, but it was one of those things. I said, right, okay, this is it. If I get a deal, I'll do it. And I just went, right, I'm doing it. Yeah. So, and I have no regrets going rugby league because I enjoyed it. And, but, you know, maybe in, I might have waited a few moments. Then again, you never know what's going to happen then. Because it was odd because I went down to Australia in 86 and to play in a Sems tournament. And, I played really well in the tournament. I scored a hat-trick against the All Blacks, and then in the first game, played against, beat France, scored a try, and Blanco's marking me, and I played against Australia, scored a try in the semi-final, but we just lost. And all of a sudden, the rugby league boys in Australia were mentioning me. So, you know, you make a call, and you've got to stick by it. And I made the call, and maybe it's a regret, but no regret in going rugby league. Mm. But the pressure was immense because, you know, the story was to, you know, to fail. That was the story. It was, oh, you know, he's never going to make it. You mentioned I was 11 and a half stone. Mm. You know, everyone's thinking, I suppose a lot of people came to watch me first of all to see if I, you know, see me get carried off. but, you know, I had belief in my own ability, and having been brought up in South West Wales, you know, it's not very different from, I suppose, I don't know why anyone would play amateur rugby league, to be honest. I used to go down and, you know, and watch Saturday morning games. I'm like, oh my God, no chance I'd play that. But hey, if, you know, it's what they love, isn't it? And here you come, it's part of, you know, of society in those areas. And it's like, I just love the whole crack up there.
I just put in finally on my indulgence in Widnes. I remember watching, it must have been a game in 1990, I think, where you played standoff. I always remember you playing in the centre in rugby league, but you played standoff. Tony must have been injured. And it was against Bradford Northern. You scored 4 tries.
Yeah.
And I remember watching it thinking, my God, this is being watched by, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 people. Yet you'd come from an amphitheatre in South Wales where, you know, however many people cram into the old Cardiff Arms Park. It was almost obscene to have that talent on show. Spare your blushes, but that was perfectly in control of a game of rugby, drifting past people like they weren't even there.
Yeah, I remember that, because Brian Noble always brings it up. He was due to do a hatchet job on me. He said he didn't get anywhere near me. But there are things like, sometimes you have opportunities to do things that, you know, you've got to take. And I remember another one was, the Lions team had been announced on this particular day. And I remember where I was, the 89 Lions team. And I was on the bus to Oldham. And I thought, right, I'm going to show them what they're missing. I'd scored two tries in the snow up in Oldham. And Mike Ford was marking me that day.
Yeah.
And Charlie McAllister was playing full back. I didn't want to get hit by Charlie McAllister, but they'll be certain of that. So it was just odd things that sometimes you had the opportunity to show what you could do. So, it was just... It's odd. You just can't explain. People say, oh, what are you thinking there? What are you thinking there? You just don't explain because you played there as a kid. And it took me a while to adjust to it, to see where the players were in rugby league. But once I got into it and understood it, then I really enjoyed the game.
And just to roll back the years as well, Jonathan, I'm not sure if Mark's going to be able to do this now, but we have got some old programmes from your Widnes days. And you talked about being the star of the show.
Yeah, I mean, leading up to that, you signing for Widnes, it was you know, it's all about the big double page spread about Mike O'Neill's testimonial, and then as soon as Jiffy was announced, the Widnes program, of which I've got a few in the loft, just became like this Beano annual devoted to Jiffy, And the expectation of that was massive. And there's the team. There's the team before you signed, which has got Alan Tate, Andy Currier, Darren Wright. You know, Martin Afaya, the Stardust.
Good side, that is.
Great side. Great side. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just, you know, for me, growing up in Widnes, my beloved Chemics, Jonathan was the final piece in the jigsaw, and for probably two or three golden years. Yeah, a bit unlucky in a few semi-finals. But, you know, my mates, we just, it was just a joy. It was a rough old area, not blessed. On a Sunday, as Jiffy says, you know, there'd be hundreds and thousands of people coming down to Norton Park. It's a shame it's plastic now in my way. But there we are.
And also, you know, Martin, to watch Martin in full flight, my God, it's not, I've seen him score some tries, you're thinking,
yeah,
bloody score that. You know, it was just mind-blowing how quick he was sometimes. And, yeah, luck, you know, you can just say I was lucky to play in that, you know, Widnes side with some great players. And you look back and think, little things you don't remember, you know, playing up in Wakefield, and Tony Myler just tells me, like, come on this short ball. And then, all of a sudden, I'm scoring a try. I'm behind my own try line. And Tony says, I'll just come on this short ball. And then I got to score then in the far corner, like about 110 yards. But and it's been lucky because all of a sudden now they show tries on, you know, on YouTube and on social media. And it's, nice to look back at them, really. And you think, oh, you know, great times, like, you know, great times, good laugh. Yeah.
And of course, as well, Jonathan, with the Widnes representation also came then, Great Britain representation as well. And Dave highlighted something to me when we were talking about getting you on the podcast about a story which involves Papua New Guinea, which doesn't sound very pleasant for any of the players involved.
No, it was a bit of a tour. I only said 3 weeks in Papua New Guinea. I thought, oh my God. So they lived and breathed again.
Yeah.
You know, they were just... And I remember Roy Powell, you know, he passed away, unfortunately, but Roy was, like, massive, and they were just in awe of him. Everywhere he went in Papua New Guinea, like, they were just clambering around him and touching him. Roy was such a lovely, lovely guy, like, Roy. He was, like, so nice to everyone, like a gentle giant. He couldn't get over the attention he was getting. But the games and the crowds and... It was so hot, you know, we'd have to be like 20 or 30 points up with 10 minutes ago because otherwise we'd get battered because we were just nothing left in the tank. It was about 100 degrees, you know, humidity, the grounds were rock hard. They were spear tackling everyone, right? So you had to edit the concrete floor. But then in one game, we had like tear gas shot into the crowd to calm them down. And then all of a sudden, the tear gas wafted over the pitch and all of it. It was just unbelievable. And they said, don't leave the hotel premises because there's cannibalism. So, you know, not things you hear when you go on tour. But what it did was, Mal Reilly and Phil Ladder absolutely flogged us, fitness-wise. 3 o'clock every day, training, just to prepare us for a three-test series in New Zealand. And everyone had written us off because they'd all dropped out. Like, all the superstars had dropped out, Ellery and Sean and all these. In fact, Scoey and Martin Fire went. Scoey was brilliant, Gary Schofield, on that trip. Yeah. We won the series and we were 2-0. Martin dropped the ball in the third test as well. We could have won 3-0. But I think we'd enjoyed the hospitality in New Zealand after winning 2-0. But it was... Yeah, again, you know, to go on tour with the likes of Martin Dermott and Beefy England, Di Bishop, Roy Power. it's just mad understanding, you know, different characters, you know, Yorkshire and Lancashire and a couple of Cumbrians. What a mixture that is. But yeah, it was brilliant. I did Australia in that period. You know, I did a tour 1990. Then I went to the Bulldogs in 91. I had a rest then because my body had a couple of hernias. And then all of a sudden I went to Warrington and I didn't really want to leave Widnes because I'd enjoyed it, but there'd been a few issues and new coaches and new players. and because financial issue, they sold Martin as well to Wigan. You know, you think of that back in 440,000. That's just unbelievable money in those days, right? Unbelievable. You know, even now you wouldn't get anywhere near that. So, and then Doug, you know, Jim just came in and said, and I was very friendly with Big Jim. They're very good friends with him. I still am. He's a great bloke.
Nice. He said,
you got to go, Jeff. I went, what do you mean? Well, you know, we can't afford your wages anymore. I'm like, oh, okay. I said, look, you can go have a free transfer. So I spoke to Wakefield. I think I spoke to Cass as well. I spoke to Castleford, Wakefield. But at that time in my career, my kids were settled. I was settled living in Widnes. I was a member of Widnes Golf Club. You know, everything was comfortable. And I thought, oh, I don't want to rock a boat now and do another move. And I don't want to travel over the M62. And then Peter Hyam spoke to me and said, look, you know, you fancy coming over? Kevin Ellis, Roland Phillips, Alan Bateman were there. And it kind of... I had a real good pre-season then, which kind of sparked me back to life. And when I went to Warrington, I think no one expected us to do that well and no one expected me to play at that level. But I just had to kind of show people that I could still play and go into a new club, you know, give me the appetite again. And I was lucky. I scored some wonderful tries for Warrington then. And again, loving the people, loving, you know, the town, and loving the boys that I played with as well. And and also, the Widnes fans knew then that I didn't want to go, so there was no animosity with them when I was living in Widnes. So I enjoyed both clubs immensely.